Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kopernik Global Investors second quarter 2020 conference call. Just a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I would like to hand the conference over to Mr. Qasim Ghaffar. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, operator. Welcome, everyone, to the second quarter 2020 conference call. My name is Qasim Ghaffar, and I have with me David Ibn, our CIO and the portfolio manager for the Kopernik Global All-Cap Strategy and Co-PM for the International Strategy, and also Alisa Cochran, our Director of Research and Analyst. Please note, Dave and Alisa will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website, www.kopernikglobal.com, under the News and View section. Also, we do have several new content, including white papers and interviews, that we have posted on our website, and encourage everyone to have a look after this call or whenever convenient. Great, let's kick it off with a quick firm update. We ended the second quarter with roughly $4.2 billion under management versus $3.1 billion at the end of Q1 2020. This represents peak assets for the firm, and the growth can be attributed to several new client additions combined with strong market appreciation for our strategies. We're also happy to have reached several milestones, although as a firm, our philosophy and process dates back several decades, and many of us have known each other and worked together for nearly as long. But as a firm, we celebrated our 7-year anniversary with July 1st. We also hit the 5-year mark for our international strategy, and we're very pleased with the results. Also, our three other portfolios, Global Long-Term Opportunity, Global Unconstrained, and Global All-Cap, also hit their 7-year mark. Lastly, on a personnel front, we've had no turnover this year again, and we are 38 people strong. And with that, I'll pass over the call over to Dave and Alisa. Dave?
All right. Thanks, Qasim. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Once again, no boredom in this market. Start off with Lewis Carroll, who is famous for his ability to turn utter nonsense into a compelling story, an entertaining story. So I really couldn't think of a better way to address the current market than through the looking glass. I've been 38 and a half years in the business. I've seen a lot of wild markets, and I've always enjoyed reading about things like the Mississippi scheme and the South Sea bubble, the tulip bulbs in Holland, you know, lived through the Japanese bubble and the TMT bubble. I haven't seen a whole lot like this market. It's really fascinating watching this melt up. So let's use that to talk about the current markets. Now, he, in his book, Through the Looking Glass, had all kinds of whimsical poems, one of which was Jabberwocky, which was invented or meaningless, you know, language or nonsense. So we have a market now where good news is bad news, and more expensive stocks are better than cheaper stocks. We have words like ZERP and NERP and quantitative easing, QE infinity, MMT, PPP, and so on. The good news through all this is with all this nonsense, we think maybe investors can capitalize on the fact that risk doesn't mean risk anymore either, or at least perceived risk is very different from what we think true risk is. Another of his poems is The Walrus and the Carpenter, which was a story really about the gullible little oysters not listening to their elders who said, don't listen to the walrus. Of course, they did. They followed them on all happily to their demise. And reading that story, one can not help but think of the Davy day traders, the Robin Hood crowds that are pouring into bankrupt stocks and the exciting stocks of the day, and of course the algos, which don't really think much at all. They just do what they're programmed to do, and that is chase momentum. So here we are in an environment where, you know, totally nuts does seem to be the new normal, and you have, as this mouse here, very defiant in the face of danger. You know, whether it's the oysters or the mouse or the people buying the NASDAQ here, they seem to not be aware that the earnings are plunging like they haven't since the 1930s, that unemployment is the worst it's been since the Great Depression. The economy is the worst it's been. There's turmoil. There's been riots in the street. None of this much seems to matter. Prices just go up. People like stories. Every time somebody comes out and says, we've got a vaccine, the whole market runs up. We have 180 firms that all have the vaccine. Of course, the press release mostly say they have a job that has a drug that has side effects that may or may not have a cure. We can hope they do. But the market's pricing in that all 180 of them are going to win. Pharma stocks now are $5.5 trillion. They're up more than 26% this year. Yeah, when I came in the business, you could buy every stock in America for less than $1 trillion. $5.5 trillion. Yeah, we hope they come up with good stuff to justify that. Even worse, of course, are the things and the tech stock. We have had until this quarter, the longest running economic expansion in history. That wonderful expansion is that little gray line at the bottom you can barely see. So certainly the economic growth does not justify that orange line, which is the NASDAQ. People love tech stocks. They love story stocks. And then the blue line, of course, is the FANGs, up 9 times almost. No need to discuss that further. Let's go on to where how we make money out of all this. The strategy, as I said, I think is to get off the beaten path. Here's a photo of a hike the other day where they, as all society does now, advises us to stay on the public trail, to stay on the beaten path. We think that's never been worse advice than now. I think with the markets the most expensive they've been ever on almost any multiple you want to consider, now is the time to get off the trail. Makes for better hikes, certainly makes for better stock portfolios. But if it's a time to go into value, what is value? I think this is most people's opinion of value. Take a bunch of crap and put a fancy name on it. Maybe. There's a lot of things that are being considered value nowadays, and we agree some people get confused on what value is. They merely look for low PE stocks. It got people in trouble back in 2008 when the low PEs and low price to books were heavily indebted bank companies, mortgage companies, retail companies, those sort of housing companies. There again, as we saw back in March, a lot of the quote value stocks, the low PEs, were retailers and industrial companies that had far too much debt, heavily indebted companies. They have potential, but they also have a lot of risk. So that hasn't proven to be value so far this year. But there are a lot of places to find value. There's a lot of cycles. So the place to look is in the nadir of the cycle. We've used this slide plenty of times in the past. We're looking for what things haven't had a bad month. We're looking for things that have had a bad decade, good companies that have had a bad decade. You've seen this chart too. Thank God for bifurcation. Back in 99, there was very expensive and there was very cheap. And right now, there's even more expensive and even cheaper. This might be the best time ever to be a value investor. Certainly, though, people are saying growth's the place to be, stocks in general the place to be, momentum stocks are the place to be because the Fed has our back. Yeah, if the Fed's going to keep doing whatever it takes to make things go up, maybe you should buy what's working. It's a pertinent question. People are right. The system's rigged. The central bankers are here to try to make stocks not go down. So here we're using an analogy. What better analog for the Fed than a pump? And for the economy, we have an air mattress. Their goal, they say, is to pump it up, and not just pump it up, their stated goal is to pump up the price of bonds. They came out with QE1 and pump up bonds is exactly what they did. And so this is showing the one section of the economy, the bond market, starting to fill up. Then they said, that's working. Let's do a little more. Maybe we can get it to expand. And a lot of this is based off stuff from Richard Cantillon a long time ago that we've talked about in the past. He said that money, look for the source. The people closest to the source of the money get rich. The rest don't. It slowly migrates out. So what are they done with the money? They bought bonds. That's where the inflation was. People say no inflation. Anybody that thinks there hasn't been inflation the last dozen years says, not paid attention to the bond market. So they printed, it worked. They came out with QE2, said maybe we can pump it up a little more, another successful step. So then they said, let's come out with QE3. QE3 did what they wanted. This inflation started leaking out of sovereign bonds into corporate bonds, high yield bonds, common stocks, even outside of assets a little bit. The government took a lot of this borrowed money and inflated the price of healthcare and education and those sort of things. Now, one would have thought that they would have declared victory. We've got prices going up. We've got assets high. The economy was doing well. People were getting back to work. Time to go to their exit strategy. Did they do that? No, they did just the opposite. They came up with QE3. Yeah, most of the air started to migrate to the less inflated areas. The inflation then famously went into venture capital, private equity, derivatives, art, real estate, cryptocurrencies. Many people are calling this a bubble in everything. The Fed claimed victory, but they started taking flack, I guess correctly so. Economists have told us for decades that printing money makes the rich richer and the poor poorer. Taking this flack, they did reverse course. But in a no-win situation, then they took flack because when they tried to exit, price of assets started to fall a little bit. And it turns out the rich don't like that so much. So round-tripped again, embarrassed. They that their exit plan was exposed as beyond unworkable. They came full speed ahead, and we now have QE infinity. They have stated they will do anything they have to do to keep the price of assets going up. Understandably, investors are ecstatic. Of course, that's what usually happens a dozen years into a bull market. It's not just investors, it's speculators that excite. Speculators are taking the plunge. I think we've all read about the Robin Hood investors, and we've all seen algorithms gone awry as people go headlong. And what are they buying? They're buying what has worked the last 12 years. Are they right to do this? Maybe. Money's got to go somewhere. But history and logic would suggest that's not how things play out. History shows that one decade's winner is usually not the next decade's winner. Matter of fact, it's usually the next decade's loser. Inflation migrates on to greener pastures. Air goes to the unpleasurized things. We're starting to, thank God, see the migration now. You're starting to see it go into gold. You're starting to see it go into other economies, other commodities, and possibly into the economy. This idea that printing money is just going to go and help stocks forever doesn't seem to work. If we want to see how this is probably going to work out for us, let's take a look at Japan. Japan's been printing a lot of money for 3 decades. They've been putting the money directly into the stock market. And their stock market is now well lower than it was in 1989. So much for printing money being the panacea. China's printed money like there's no tomorrow ever since the financial crisis. Seems like their market's up big. It's not. Take a look. It's gone nowhere for the last decade. Europe, they were a couple of years ahead of us in saying that their central bank will do whatever it takes to support stocks, and it hasn't worked there. I don't know why we think it's going to work here. But, yeah, history will suggest that we're at that point in the cycle where things have inflated enough, and what's already been inflated can't be inflated that much more. How high can the price of housing go before the price of rents need to be inflated up? And how high can rents go without people's wages, their ability to pay those rents, being inflated up? How long can the price of food stocks go up without the price of food going up, and energy stocks go up without the price of energy going up? Eventually it pours into commodities, into food, into basic stuff, and into the value stocks that tend to be associated with these later stages of inflation. So whether we're talking air, water, money, you name it, things follow the path of least resistance. So go to the areas that aren't already pressurized. So we think that investors might be neglecting the winners as they dangerously pour in to last decade's winners, the dangerous parts of the area. Correctly picking where the money might go is really important, because the Fed has upgraded their game. They've gone to a big pump. We're talking trillions of dollars. We're talking more money printed in the last few months than had been printed in the previous 100 years. This is a lot of money. More on the concept of where it might go. We bought it from Mark Saber, who talked about his fictive uncle that can make things changes every once a decade. It is weird why the decade would matter. You wouldn't think decades would, but they seem to. In the 60s, like now, but a small version of now, you had the government spending out of control, guns and butters, they called it. All that required monetization. The Fed accommodated, and as usual, the price of assets went up. You had stocks go up. You had growth stocks do really well. Technology was the place to be. Growth was the place to be. 70s, they kept printing money. They printed a lot of money. It was an inflationary period. Did the money keep going into growth stocks? Nah. Stocks had a particularly bad decade, especially growth stocks. No, the money went into gold, it went into energy, it went into emerging markets, and it was a bad time to be in stocks and bonds. Then, of course, after a wonderful decade, the following decade was a disaster for gold and for energy, and it was the time to be in Japanese equities. They were behaving a whole lot like U.S. equities are right now. And it was a fun time down in Japan. We didn't, of course. Next decade was a bad time to be in Japanese equities. As a matter of fact, they have underperformed ever since. The 90s were, of course, the famous time to be in the NASDAQ. It was the tech, media, telecom bubble. That was doing well. Japan was doing poorly. The odd decade, of course, was a disaster for the NASDAQ, as it gave back 80-some percent. The real growthy stocks gave back 90 to 100% of their gains. Really tough time to be in there. While that was happening, oil went from $20 to $140. Gold went from $255 to $1,900. It was a very nice time to be in these areas. It was a good time to be in emerging markets. People coined the phrase the BRICS. You must own Brazil. You must own Russia. You must own India. You absolutely must own China. Those, of course, did well then, and they've been not the place to be the last 10 years. And, of course, gold up until the last year or so was a bad place to be. Energy continues to be a tough time. The place to be the last 10 years was U.S. stocks and, of course, bonds. We would suggest that bonds clearly will make you nothing other than a speculative trade. They yield nothing. And in real terms, adjusted for inflation, are all but guaranteed to lose economic value for people. U.S. stocks are priced at levels that suggest subpar returns, if they're even positive. So probably a good time to avoid those. And most importantly, what should you own? It's pretty clear there's a lot of things that you should be very reluctant to own going forward. Well, as far as what to, there are in a bifurcated market a lot of things to look at. So everybody wants to own the FANGs. Since we're using the Walrus and the Carpenter and Lewis Carroll, instead of using FANGs, Walrus have tusks. So we have coined the phrase tusk. And to talk about the many, many opportunities, incredibly attractive opportunities we see using our acronym, I'll turn it over to our Director of Research, Elisa Corcoran.
Thanks, Dave. As Dave mentioned, we prefer a different long tooth acronym, the TUSK, and we think it is a perfect time to get off of the FANG beaten path and trespass into the TUSKs. As you can see, the market cap of the six tech stocks make up $7 trillion. And for half of that price in the TUSKs, you get all of emerging market telecom, all of emerging market utilities, uranium mining companies, all silver and other precious metal mining companies in the world, and every single company in South Korea. As active managers, when entire sectors and countries go on sale, this is an active manager's dream because we get to sift through and find the best bargains. So we'll start with telecom. A huge dislocation in the market today we're seeing is the valuations between emerging markets and developed markets. Emerging markets have gone nowhere for a decade. Meanwhile, the stock markets of developed markets are up multiple times. So you can see this in telecom. Today, we can buy Korea's version of Verizon and China's version of Verizon for a tenth of the price per subscriber. They are cheap on book value. They even have tangible book value, while Verizon doesn't, and cheap on earnings as well. So, yes, we agree that Verizon is a great franchise. We just think that the also great franchises in emerging markets are better investments. Utilities is the same story. On a relative basis, emerging market utilities are much cheaper than their developed market counterparts. And on an absolute basis, they're extremely cheap. We are buying the world's second largest hydroelectric power company and Russia's largest power company for half of book value and five times earnings. So these are incredible opportunities and very, very good prices for extremely good franchises. Silver mining, uranium mining, gold mining, we've grouped all of these together. We've spent a lot of time in previous quarterly calls talking about what the upside potential we think in these commodities. We've spent less time on how we view the mining companies that we're investing in. And many view this industry as completely uninvestable. We think this is an extremely important topic, and we've decided to allocate an entire hour to this on September 10th. It is going to be our first topic of our new webinar series. And the cliff notes to that webinar, we hope you tune in, but the cliff notes is that mining companies come with a lot of baggage. We are very much aware of this baggage, but the upside potential more than offsets the risks. So I hope you tune in. We'll be discussing how we value mining companies, how we assess the risk, and the opportunities that we're seeing today. In South Korea, I think it's helpful to put the FANGs market cap into perspective. So for less than $5 trillion, we can buy four of the world's major economies. Today, we are given the choice of buying Apple for $1.6 trillion or buying Korea, South Korea, and its version of Apple, Samsung, and every other South Korean company for less than what you would buy for Apple. So we are choosing South Korea. South Korea trades below its level in 2007. Meanwhile, the S&P and the NASDAQ are up 2-3.5 times since 2007. It's trading at below book value. We think South Korea and the U.S. are at extremes. And to demonstrate this extreme, we are comparing Hyundai versus Tesla. So Tesla has 14 times the market cap, but Hyundai makes 14 times the number of cars. Hyundai is cheap on earnings, it's cheap on cash flow, it's cheap on sales, it's cheap on tangible book value, and like Tesla, it should benefit from this movement into electric vehicles as they'll make roughly a third the number of cars as Tesla will in electric vehicles. So we think clearly Hyundai is the better investment of these two. If we want to add an S to our acronym, you could add small cap. The passive investing boom has led to a massive underperformance of small cap names, and as a result, much better valuations, as these charts demonstrate. And as you can see, this is not just a phenomenon in the U.S., it is happening globally. Adding another S to our acronym, you could add scarcity. We've shown this chart in the past, and we'll keep showing it because it actually just keeps on getting better. Real assets versus financial assets are at an all-time low. We believe we're in a cyclical market. These real assets are priced to do very well, even without any QE that Dave mentioned. So this is a glimpse of what we're seeing in the market, the opportunities we're taking advantage of, and to talk more about risk, I'll pass it back over to Dave.
All right, thank you. Back at the beginning, we were talking about Jabberwocky and words that don't necessarily mean anything. Risk, we think, is an opportunity. We think the fact that, as Howard Marks talks about a lot, what is risk to one person is not risk to another. When people have different mindsets, it creates opportunity for those of us that worry about risk to the portfolio, risk of absolute permanent loss of capital. We try to avoid that. Other people have other things on their mind. They may be shorter term, or certainly career risk is a huge factor in our business. So because of that, it gives us an opportunity to actually lower risk by buying what other people might view as higher risk. For one thing, we hear a lot about dead money. People are famously impatient nowadays, especially in rip-roaring markets. So conventional view, in the long run, we're all dead. Show me the money now. And Kopernik's view, time increases the value of options. And so many of the companies that are cheap now have this massive valuable optionality. We think a little more time sometimes is better. Volatility famously is considered risk by lots and lots of people. It's people's definition of risk. We're worried about permanent loss of capital. We don't worry about temporary loss of capital. That's part of being an investor, we think. Volatility causes discomfort. It causes short-term pain. Those are unfortunate, but that's the price we have to pay. We view the resultant low prices that you get to pay after a volatile drop as a good thing. It decreases risk, increases opportunity. I think we all got to see that recently. We were able to buy some good companies at dirt cheap prices back in the middle of March. Volatility is opportunity, not risk. Certainty is interesting. People will pay up a lot for certainty. They will accept a 60 basis point return on a 10-year treasury. In Europe, they'll take no return. In some countries, they'll take a guaranteed loss every year for 10 years as long as it's certain. And we will let other people do that. Our view of certainty about the future is that it's an illusion. And so people shouldn't pay for certainty that doesn't exist anyhow. They certainly shouldn't be paying the high prices they're paying now. Things that are viewed as uncertain, things that do not have a catalyst, people will sell at almost any price, thereby leading some of these things to such low prices that, you know, 90% of the future outcomes are going to be positive. It's actually lower risk, higher return when the returns are uncertain. So people, I think, are overly obsessed with catalysts and pretending they know what's going to happen next quarter. Headline risk is a fascinating topic. Nobody wants that bad day where you get up and read in the headlines of the paper that bad things have happened to your company or your stock or the industry they're in or the country they're in. It's not fun. But headlines usually lead to emotions, and emotions lead to mispricing. And so the things that get a lot of bad headlines often get priced down to such low levels that they actually become less risky and more attractive. Lisa talked a little bit about small caps, but in a late-stage bull market where people embrace passive, and in this case embrace ETFs, they have no tolerance for the smaller caps, and you saw in the chart she showed how unbelievably cheap some small stocks have gotten in contrast to how expensive these big dominant passive ETF things have become. So most people view small cap as inconvenient and not so useful. We view it as great opportunity, and that's one reason why we dedicate ourselves to staying at a manageable size so we can take advantage of these opportunities. Tracking error, people say, well, markets only go up. Why should you bother owning something that might not track the index? But markets go up and down. And whereas tracking error makes underperformance possible, it also is a requirement for outperformance. And if there was ever a time not to want to track the indexes, it's at a time when the indexes are the most expensive they've been in history that I'm aware of. So we are very, very happy to not be tracking the indexes right now. The result of not tracking the index is in the most expensive market in history. This portfolio is barely over half of book value. As things, not much over one time sales. So we're talking on most metrics, very attractive valuations. And as I pointed out earlier, metrics aren't everything. This is a portfolio of mostly worldwide industry leaders, and certainly regional leaders, but usually global leaders, good companies with generally solid barriers to entry. And that's what's trading at these sort of multiples. And it's a portfolio that tends to have a lot less debt than the indexes do in general also. So good companies at low prices should eventually do well. We're buying a lot of things that we think the optionality for 2, 3, 4, 5 times upside. Let's just go with 2 side times upside. This chart indicates that if it doubles this year, we'll all be very, very happy. If it takes 5 years to double, that's 15% annual return. If it took 10 years to double, and things don't take that long, we're talking 7% return. We will let other people have 70 basis point return on their 10-year bond. We'll go for 10 times that on one of the most, the slowest imaginable case. So a good time to be buying assets that have value, that have usefulness, that have barriers, that are distinct, and meet people's needs, that have this not just potential but probability of doubling. Volatility, we mentioned, is opportunity. I think we talked last quarter how in the first quarter we were able to sell GE at 11.5 and buy it back at 6.5. That is what volatility allows us to do. It allowed us in the first quarter to be trimming names like, or to be adding in names like New Gold and Centerra, to be trimming them later in this quarter, Centerra, New Gold, Polyus, and be able to buy names that had fallen, like Ivanhoe, that have since bounced, Newcrest, which has since bounced, It's allowed us to get into names at the cheapest they've been in many, many years, like Cenovus Energy and Embraer, asset manager, Franklin Resources. So in both global and international, very similar. The volatility is our friend. It gives us opportunities to take advantage of markets like this. We think volatility is probably here to stay. Maybe it's hopeful, because that is definitely a good thing for active managers, the ones that are taking the time to appraise businesses and take advantage of the fickle market that changes its mind on valuations from day to day. So with that, why don't I pause and open it up to questions.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question today, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, everyone, it is star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. We'll take our first question today from David Niehaus, Merrill Lynch.
Hi there, Dave. Thanks for the call. I was just hoping you could discuss where the current valuation of the portfolio falls relative to the historical range of valuations for your universe. Thank you.
Okay. Well, valuations, we have the one sheet here that shows, in general, half a book value, which is pretty good. Put things in practice. You know, 38 and a half years I've been doing this. 1982 was very cheap. 91, the small stocks were cheap. And again, in 2000, the small stocks were cheap. January of 2016 was just unbelievably cheap. And this portfolio is right in the league with all those. It is certainly, if not the most attractively valued we've ever had, certainly in the top two, three markets in general. As far as if we were going to compare this to some of the other ones, especially what 2016 before the portfolio, I think it went 93% in 6 months. Of course, that's been the highlight of the last 7 years, which has been very, very difficult for our style. But before that blast off, similar valuations to this, the gold stocks were cheaper then. They've had a really good year, but they're still a lot more expensive than they were then. But historic to gold, they are still amongst the cheaper markets that we've ever seen. Uranium's starting to bounce, but it's still cheaper than it was back in 2016. Things like Russia, that we took a lot of flack for back then when it was 19% of the portfolio, has probably been the best performing market on earth since then. So it's nowhere near as cheap as it was in 2016, but it's still the cheapest market on earth. Energy's cheaper now than it was then. Natural gas, some of these stocks are 80% cheaper than I think they were back then. We had that slide on South Korea, but you know, we're paying half a book value or less for good companies. LG, a big conglomerate that's got a lot of good things going for it. You heard the Hyundai story. We've got an auto parts company, a tire company. We also mentioned Korea Telecom, one of the cheaper stocks on earth. So that's cheaper. And we now have more opportunities to buy industrials, and we've looked at some consumer stocks. So some things are cheaper, some are more expensive. But in general, in any market, I'd be very happy to have market leaders at half a book value, and especially to do that when the market as a whole is the most expensive in history. So hopefully that answers it. It's pretty cheap relative to everything.
Thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one to ask a question today. We'll go next to Chris Brady, Brady Financial.
Hi, Dave. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. Quick question. I know that when they put option, when you were able to monetize that, a lot of the funds came in cash, and I think at the time we didn't put it completely to work. I don't know if that's we kind of put most of that to work already or you're still holding some cash. I don't know if you wanted to speak to that for a minute or so to update us on
sure.
the position and if we're holding anything for the future or just we put it all to work already.
Yeah, sure. As people know, we're, you know, equity manager, but over time we've had opportunities to take advantage of mispricing and convertibles, bonds or high-yielding bonds or things like the uranium fund we own, things like that. So we're willing when the market makes it compelling to do something different. So put options, of course, are things that gain value when a market drops. Our view was that the central banks have not eliminated the cycle, that things go up, things go down. The market had gone the longest it had ever gone without dropping and become quite expensive. So obviously the value of a put option should become very expensive. It's more valuable. It's more valuable when the market's high, less valuable when the market's low. The market, of course, makes mistakes, and it priced the thing not as more valuable. It priced it as the cheapest that it's really ever been. It probably deserved to be at implied vol being one of the main determinants of the price you pay for the option. Probably should have been 20-something. It was bouncing around between 8 and 14. So we started buying it. Would have been nice to buy it and have the market drop the next day, but we were 3 years too early. The market being the longest ever just kept going for three more years. So that cost us money for the last 3 years. We made pretty much all of it back in March. So that was kind of nice. So if you add the last 3.5 years, I think we lost 2%. So it was not a winning strategy. If you go back 2 years, it was a winning strategy. For this year, it's been a real nice strategy. But even though we lost 2%, so call it 60 basis points a year over the last 3+ years, I think we made back a lot more than that because, you know, it's always nice when one stock drops to sell another to buy the one that drops. But when every stock drops, it was panic. You guys were all there. You saw what happened in March. It was pandemonium. Everything was dropping, and especially value stocks were dropping. So if we hadn't had that put option, we would have rode our stocks down and rode them back up again. Because of the put option, we rode the stocks down, sold most of the put, raised 1,000 basis points of cash, and invested in the stocks that were down and other stocks that had fallen big. And so it not only turned a disastrous March into an okay March, it helped make April and May a tremendous month. So, we sold almost the whole put in March, and we invested pretty much all that cash at the bottom. So, that cash is spent. And then to go with cash, like a lot of value-oriented managers, cash to us is a residual of the process. We value stocks, and the more they go down, the more cash we spend, and buy more of them, the more a stock goes up, the more we're trimming them. We don't like them quite as much as we did at lower prices. Every day on the trading desk, we're trying to add to some stocks. We're trying to trim some more stocks. And so in a month like March, the purchases are getting done. It was easy buying stocks. What we've seen the last 3 months is a breathtaking melt up in stocks. So one might expect our cash balances are going back up again. So the cash balances went from 10 to closer to zero to back to 10 plus minus now. So the cash was all spent, but is starting to build back up again now, as one I think should expect.
Okay, super. Thank you.
Up next, we'll hear from Rick Spiedel, Ameriprise.
Thank you. Listen to your podcast with Grant Williams and Stephanie Pomboy recently. You referenced that one of the mining companies that disposed of an asset at what you deemed to be unfavorable price. Not to get ahead of your September webinar, but I was wondering if you could just talk about how you monitor and maintain comfort levels with respect to managements of the mining companies in particular. You have a couple of dozen names in the portfolio, 25%+ of the overall portfolio. Is there an ongoing monitoring of the level of execution or lack thereof of these managements over time, or is it predominantly based on what you perceive to be the assets that they hold?
Okay, great question. I can answer it now without really getting into a lot of the stuff that we will be going into in September. And I recommend if people have a chance listening to that, because I think it's important. We know most people don't like gold or uranium or those sort of things. And the people that do like gold and uranium won't touch gold stocks. And when people won't touch something, usually that means they've been sold at too low a price. So we'll talk about how we price them and how we risk adjust them. But just quickly, Stephanie Pomboy and Grant Williams, I've known them both for years. They do a great job. People that like value investing, I think a month ago, talked to Bob Rodriguez, who was a legend for the last 30 years. So they do a really good job interviewing. So, they're great sources, and I read both their research a lot. In terms of the mining companies, we view the positives as absolutely real. Scarce goods, when demand should grow with the population, with the economy, they have value. When money is being printed like there's no tomorrow, then gold, of course, has a lot of value, so that's good. The mining companies own gold, which is wonderful, but so much can go wrong. Managements, they're human beings. They get carried away and get optimistic at the top. They get pessimistic at the bottom. They buy the wrong time. They sell the wrong time. Countries have decided that maybe they shouldn't take 2% of the economics. They should take 30% of the economics. The chemistry, the geology, there's all kinds of challenges. So because of those challenges, it's important to diversify. So we have a lot of what we think are really good companies, but we have different management teams, different countries, different currencies, different geologies, different chemistries. And so something can go wrong in one place and you're diversified. What we also do is we try to make sure we have plenty of upside. So if you're going to be wrong on one or two names, it's nice to have another eight, not just going up, but going up big. And we will point out that in 2008 and 2016, both of those years, we had a couple companies that we stubbed our toe on, and yet those were both sort of career years for us because so many of the other ones did go up five, six, seven times. And so having upside is important. And then as far as monitoring, this isn't just for mining companies, for every company in the portfolio. We believe that value is not a philosophy, it's a prerequisite. Nobody should ever pay full price for something, certainly not overpay. We demand a discount for everything. And we want bigger discounts if there's debt. We want bigger discounts if they're in emerging markets or other things where other countries where we worry about the business friendliness of the environment or the integrity of the environment. We want bigger discounts for businesses that have low barriers to entry and so forth. And so we tend to give pretty low scores to most of these gold miners. We do recognize that they're in a tough business, and we do realize that a lot of them panic and sell properties at the wrong time. So we had one company where, you know, they had assured us they were not going to sell off this property, and they did. And they sold it to another company that seems to have a good track record, so we fortunately were able to buy the company they sold it to, so maybe we'll capture back some of that economics. But when a company does do that, we've generally had a low score to begin with, but then we lower our management score. So when we're risk adjusting, we say, what score do we give management? What score do we give the country? What score do we give the balance sheet? What score do we give the quality of the assets? We factor those things in. And the company that sold, we already had them scored pretty low, but they're scored even lower now. But to give you examples how this can work, we had a company back in 2016. There was a whole host of reasons we said, we don't want to own them unless it's trading 90% off. You know, we wanted to pay only 10% of what we thought it was worth. We fortunately were able to buy it at a couple percent of what we thought it was worth. The stock went up 20-something times that year, and we were able to sell a lot of it. But then we had others I mentioned we lost money on, too. So, but if we risk adjust, and we do, we spend a lot of time risk adjusting, and then September we can go and do a lot more factors of how we're valuing the ounces and how we go about risk adjusting management and what we're looking for. It's something we spend hours on every week. So I can't do much in 5 minutes now. It will do a little better in 1 hour. But it's a very, very important topic and a good question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Gallagher of UBS Financial Services is next.
Yeah, hi, Dave. Was wondering if you could just discuss the energy space. Seems like the short term and maybe the real long term are problematic, but the intermediate term could be amazing. And I was wondering if you've done any reshuffling there.
We wouldn't disagree with what you said. The near term is certainly challenging. Long term, quite possibly challenging. But the idea that 7.5 billion people are going to wean themselves off of hydrocarbons in the next 5 years is it doesn't seem too credible. So we are taking advantage of the fact that people do change their minds on things. We've taken advantage over the years that people have liked natural gas and not liked oil, and a few years later they like oil and don't like coal, and a few years later they like coal, don't like hydroelectric power, that sort of thing. So we continue to do that. It was amazing how you used to have to pay a big premium for businesses that were light on greenhouse gases when we're looking for and pollution. Well, and now we think the two biggest, best hydroelectric power generation, no greenhouse gas. They're selling very, very cheaply. Nuclear power, of course, people went from loving that in the 60s to hating it in the 80s and 90s to loving it again a dozen years ago because of the low pollution and low greenhouse gases. And then, of course, hating it after Fukushima. So our favorite area within energy for a while has been not just the nuclear power, but the uranium producers that sell into it. people loved it so much they ran the price up to $137 a pound. Then it dropped to 18. 18 was so absurdly low. Even at 33, it's almost doubled, still absurdly low. Instead of people saying it's double the TAD capacity, people are saying it's way too low. Let's take capacity off. And so the last two or three years, you've had people shut down capacity for, you've had Cameco shut down their biggest mine. You've had Kazakhstan cut back a few times. You had the Russians stop selling. You had the U.S. government stop selling. More recently with COVID, you've had Cameco shut their second biggest mine. You've had Kazakhstan cut back again. You've had two other big mines in Africa shutter themselves. You've had funds set up to buy uranium. You've had Japan bring back 9 reactors. You don't read about that much. You've had China came out last week and said, we expect in the next 5 years to have 30 new reactors running. Inventories keep falling. The price is going to need to at least double, or these things are going to be, these multi-billion dollar plants are going to just be shuttered, and that's not going to happen. Little more recently, you've seen a few years ago, demand for natural gas was, you know, or demand's been growing nicely. Supply of natural gas was going way too fast. People were borrowing billions of dollars and drilling holes left and right. That was not a good time to be in the energy space. Now the price of gas and oil have both dropped significantly, even after recent bounces, that people are not drilling. See the drilling numbers. That's the time to get interested in commodities, when they're selling below what we call the incentive price. And so if things are below the incentive price, supply drops until price goes up to incentivize it again. So we with every commodity we have, we look a lot at this incentive price. We view oil as well below its incentive price, and natural gas to be really exciting here. And gas is down, but as I mentioned before, these natural gas stocks, even after tripling in the last few months, they're still down 80 to 90% from where they were 4 or 5 years ago when people were too excited on energy. Yeah, so you watch it. When prices are high, people say, oh my God, 7.5 billion people, where are we possibly going to get enough energy to meet their needs? And when you've had a bad couple of years like now, we hear we're awash with gas. We'll never be able to handle all this gas. But supply's dropping. Demand took a quick hit with COVID, but not counting that, it's been a growth business. And it's one of those businesses where the U.S. is actually a fairly low-cost producer. The U.S. is an exporter just in the last year or so. You've seen this big increase in export facilities. You've also seen people move chemical plants back to the U.S., other plants to the U.S. If the price of Tesla is even 10% right in terms of what demand for electric cars are going to be, that's going to require electricity, which will mostly, you know, be generated from the base load and natural gas. That'll be a lot of the incremental. So we would agree with you that in the short term, the price of hydrocarbons and most forms of energy are unsustainably low. They might struggle for a while, but in the intermediate term, they have to find their way to a higher level. And then longer term, who knows?
Thanks, Dave.
Up next from Morgan Stanley is Alex Podoradekich.
Thank you. Thank you for the call, David. I wonder if you could maybe just spend a minute on your outlook for silver and also just the valuations of the streaming companies versus the better known miners.
Certainly. Take the streamers first. Streamers are a good business. We've always liked them. You've got the advantages of the mining companies, i.e., control of something that's highly, highly likely to appreciate in the future. And you don't have the negatives of the miners. If the miners have cost overrun, the streamers, and for those of you who don't know, they will loan money, but instead of getting a guaranteed interest rate back, they get so many ounces of silver back in return, or the equivalent thereof. So they get the upside of silver. They don't get the cost. So if a silver company has cost overruns, bad for the miner, not bad for the streamer and royalty companies. If government comes along and says we're raising the royalty, bad for the mining company, not bad for the streamer. So these are good businesses. We like them. The market tends to like them too. They're just clearly good. So we're looking for places where we have a different opinion than the market. So there was 4 or 5 years ago where the streamers went on sale and we bought 3 of them. Since then we've sold 2 of them. We still have Wheaton Precious Metals, and that's had quite a run the last 6 months. So we've trimmed a good bit of that one too. We like the industry, and we are happy to own them every time the market wants to misprice them. Silver, it's easy to talk about gold and oil because they have a price that incentivizes people to look for them, produce them. Silver is a byproduct, natural gas sometimes is a byproduct, so they can get wildly out of whack. The bad news is it's so much harder to predict where they're going to be, and they can get so much further out of whack. That's also the good news. When things get way out of whack, you get a potential really big return. So the chance that natural gas goes up 5 times from here is quite likely. Silver, keep in mind, gold is approaching its all-time highs right now. Silver back in 1980 and again 5 years ago reached levels that are 2.5 times higher than it is now. Silver got to 50 on 2 occasions. So, silver, for people that can handle volatility, it's hard not to really like silver. If you look at the ratio to gold over the years, famously 120 years ago, there was a whole election predicated on Williams Jennings Bryan wanting to go to a silver standard at, I think, a 16-to-1 ratio to gold. There was so much silver being discovered, that was the form of easy money back then. I think a few months ago, that 16-to-1 got out to 135-to-1, maybe bigger. Now it's come in, but 90-to-100-to-1, the idea that that won't come back to 50-to-1. So we like silver. A lot of our gold companies have silver, and we have 3 or 4 companies that are mostly silver. So silver has huge potential. It's way below the cost that we think is sustainable over time.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we'll take a question from Bradley Calder, TIFF.
Hi, Dave.
Hi.
So I just wanted to ask you a question about page 33, where you were talking about Korea. So I totally understand why you might think that Tesla is overvalued. Just taking it the other side of it, though, in terms of Hyundai, like when I look at the financials, I see a company with, low single-digit returns on capital, low single-digit returns on equity, a very low payout ratio, which is super common in Korea. So you'd expect their, expected growth rate to be pretty low. And, operating income and EBITDA has fallen by 50% over the last 5 years. So, I see this as a highly competitive, business selling cars, where they have dozens of competitors. So I guess it just doesn't strike me as a cheap company. I mean, it strikes me as a company that's in a sort of challenged industry. that's highly competitive. So can you help me understand, like, what you see here? Like, why is this a, you know, an underpriced company and not just a bad industry to be in? Thanks.
Yeah, let's take two sides. Let's take the less important part first. In 1999 and again now, we choose not to own some very, very good companies because everybody loves the very, very, very good companies. And we saw in 1929 and 1972 and 1999 and even in 07, turns out that very, very good companies can be very, very bad stocks because price is really important. And so, certainly if you were very patient on Microsoft and Amazon, you lost 80% of your money and then made it back a zillion times over since then. But 99 was not the time to buy those. And if you bought most of the other technology companies, you never recovered. And so we will look at things like Apple at $1.6 trillion and Amazon and Microsoft at pretty similar amounts. They're good companies. We wish them well. It's hard not to admire them. If the future goes really well, maybe you make some money from here if anything goes wrong. If the numerator is $1.6 trillion, the denominator is going to have to work really hard to support that. And if we're wrong and the stocks go higher, God love them, whatever. We will let other people do that. But they're very, very loved. Tesla, as you point out, the auto business is an awful business. I mean, we had this thing, I can't remember how many pages it was of companies that existed 100 years ago, 130 years ago, that are gone. Auto companies often don't make it. Most of the ones were Ford and GM and Chrysler, it's tough times. And these guys dominated the world back in the 50s. It is a tough, tough business. And so Tesla comes along, and it's hard not to admire them. They've sort of changed the model. And not only does EV make a lot of sense, but waste fewer parts, but they've done a good job of getting people to embrace it. And they've got a car that's got all this great computer stuff and downloads everything overnight. And it's got this whole contingent of people that love it. And so, hard not to root for them and hope they do well. I like the cars. I know a lot of people that like the cars. When an unproven company that's still struggling and trying to get the quality right and really doesn't make any money yet and certainly doesn't make very many cars now has a market cap that is the biggest of all the auto companies that they have left Toyota in the dust now. Toyota spent how many decades carving out their place as the biggest, most valuable car company. They're embraced all over the world, admired for their quality and a lot of things. And Tesla is valued at more than that. We will let other people do that. My guess is that Tesla as a company does fairly well and Tesla stock gets just slaughtered from here. That's my guess. But like I say, that's not the important part of the equation. The important part of the equation is the growth will do what it does. What about value? What constitutes value? So let's keep in mind that Tesla and Hyundai are in the same business. Yeah, they both make electric cars, and on the side, Hyundai also makes 5,000 internal combustion engine cars. They're in similar business. I guess we can't compare it to Tesla's profitability because Tesla doesn't have any profitability to compare it to. But to compare it to a very profitable company, we say, what should a company earn? Yeah, if you look at an industry and say, here's a bunch of companies and they're all pretty equal. What have they earned over time? What should they make now? And so, as you point out, they don't have a lot of profitability. and they're still 7.9 times earnings. That's 7.9 times what they've been able to make at the down part of their cycle. You know, they've struggled. Now they're starting to come out with some new stuff. Maybe the cycle turns. But we like companies where the market is assuming nothing good happens. And things are so cheap that we think we can do well, even if we're wrong on the thesis that it's a pretty good company. So if they never start making any more money than they're making now, we're happy owning something at 8 times earnings. So that means, of course, a 12.5% earned return on our investment every year. Yeah, they are 40% of tangible book. They have factories. They've got a lot of stuff that should be of value. So if this is not a very good company, we probably still make money paying 8 times earnings. If it's an okay company and they start making not good returns, just okay returns, the earnings go up a lot. The multiple in those earnings probably go up a lot. So on a risk-reward basis, don't see how we lose a lot from here, and there's potential to make a whole lot. And this you'll see throughout the portfolio. You know, we are in a market right now that when a company is in its up part of the cycle, the market is paying obscene prices for things that are running on all cylinders right now, so to speak. So we like buying things where there's a decent chance that they make a lot of cash flow. You know, we're talking things like Korea Telecom or as we've talked about in the past, the energy companies, the gold companies. A lot of these things are, they should do okay even if we're wrong, but if they can just get somewhat average in terms of what we think future returns are, we'll make a lot of money. So we are not a deep value reversion to the mean buy companies that are not doing well. But that's where we do our fishing. We look for, of all the companies that aren't earning good returns right now, do they deserve it? And yeah, a lot of companies, when they start underproducing, they're on their way out. But we think we have a portfolio of companies that are pretty good at what they do, that have a chance of reverting to the mean, that actually should be expected to revert into the mean. And we showed the chart that if we even have to wait 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years to revert to the mean, we still are going to make a lot of money. To us, that's value investing. It's not buying cheap stocks. It's buying good companies when they're priced cheap. When do things get priced cheap? When times are tough. Hyundai, over the last 20 years, I don't know that many car companies have been more successful in terms of how much they've grown and how much they've improved their image. They've got a pretty good franchise. It's not Rolls Royce, but it's a very good franchise, we believe. And we think not much downside with lots of upside from current valuations.
Thanks, Dave. Gotcha. I understand what you mean. Thank you.
At this time, there are no further questions. Mr. Ivan, I'll hand things back to you for additional or closing remarks.
Okay. Well, once again, appreciate everybody dialing in. Appreciate your support. Certainly fun markets, interesting markets, and look forward to talking to you again in 3 months. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. We would like to thank you all for your participation today. You may now disconnect.